Welcome, everyone. We have reached the conclusion to our series in Paul's letter to the Romans. So this is a series we've been doing for several weeks now. So this is the conclusion. We're going to cover chapters 14 through 16. And the way we're going to do it is through three threads that I think are worth calling out where really, like, even if you haven't been here for this series so far, with each of these threads, the main point that we have been building towards the entire time will be very clear in the discussion that we're going to have today. And so those three threads that I want to bring us through is money, meat, and mentions. Now, if you're thinking, now it is less clear to me what Romans is about than it was before you said that. That's okay. Come along with me through each of these threads, and I guarantee you we'll find ourselves in one unified place in the end. So we'll start with money. Specifically, not just like money in general, as New Testament writers and Jesus and writers in the Old Testament have often talked about, but specifically what we often call the Lord's money, that other holy bread, basically like the way our church spends money. I always find that it's funny to call it the Lord's money as if all the other money that you have and spend is not also the Lord's, because the Lord knows every dollar you've spent on Dogecoin and NFT. You can't like hide that from him. But we are specifically, we're going to talk about what we would call like the money that we have collectively pooled as a church to like handle for a variety of things. The reason we're going to bring that up is because in these last couple chapters, the Apostle Paul brings it up, and he brings it up kind of in passing as part of like a broader point that he's going to make, but he does bring it up nevertheless, and I think that it's worth dwelling on that a little bit, because the whole point behind Paul bringing up this like collection that he cares so much about very much is something that comes from the core message that he's trying to put forward in the letter to the Romans. So when we think of how churches spend money, I know that, and it should be, something that is very like challenging and fraught, something that requires a lot of deep reflection, sometimes comes with discomfort. When you think about maybe not necessarily how your own church spends money, but how churches have in general over the centuries, right? There is, I know, like, I have some of these feelings, for example, when, like many of us do, when we think about historically the enormous amount of resources we have sometimes poured into beautiful, ornate, luxury buildings, right? It's very common for, people, and this is true for all kinds of religions and spiritual expressions, right? To have these kinds of buildings that simultaneously inspire awe, but come at a tremendous financial cost to make it happen. And it raises questions of that, very basic questions like, is this the best use of the money that we all pooled together? Is it what Jesus would have wanted, right? Like, these are good questions to ask and think through. Another angle where this shows up is how we use our money to pay the professional Jesus people, pay the people who like do these kinds of things like running church and teaching you like for a living. And I know, again, like in our culture today, that comes up often when you look at various pastors, especially ones that have like very big audiences. And you think about how much they're paid or how they live their lives. There's this idea of conspicuous consumption, right? You have like pastors wearing designer clothing and cool sneakers, and there's like all kinds of discussions online about like, look at how much their wardrobe costs, and is that the best use of their money, right? It draws all kinds of criticisms, great discussions there. Again, I think that they are inherently challenging and good discussions to have. I, as a pastor who teaches you all, circumvent those entire challenges of conspicuous consumption by wearing athleisure at all times. So you think it's because, it's not because, it's extremely comfortable and I get to feel like I'm wearing pajamas in public. That's not why. It's actually humility. You're welcome. I'm doing this for you. But there are like all kinds of other facets that this shows up, right? Like, it's like, well, how do, especially pastors who have large audiences multinationally, how do they get from place to place, right? There's always discussions about like, how do they spend money on their transportation and their private jets and so on. I have been in, like, you know, across the country. You know, we, like, when we were back home in the Midwest recently, in the Chicago area, we were talking to this couple who were saying that they would never be comfortable with a pastor who drives a Tesla, for example. This was part of, like, again, when you unpack it, like in those discussions, there is this kind of internal dialogue that we all have about, like, wait, did people who do this for a living, did they, like, take on a vow of poverty in order to do it? Because in some Christian traditions over the centuries, they have. And a lot of times we get the idea that, like, you know, we have conflicting ideas, like they should be paid well so that they can do their job really well. And they shouldn't be so rich. I mean, come on, they gotta be a person of the people. Right? Like, there are all these kinds of layers that go to it. I think it's funny in particular to, like, use the example of, like, they shouldn't drive a Tesla as an example, because if you've spent time at Spark, you know that not only do many of us drive Teslas, we flaunt it. We say, come to our church. You can, you can check out electric vehicles as part of, like, you know, our way of encouraging people to drive sustainably. In fact, I remember when we had this, people were supposed to bring in their cars. Debbie very kindly told us that they have enough Tesla Model Ys that were volunteered to showcase so that we didn't have to. That's the kind of conspicuous consumption we may have going on here. But again, I really do think that it's always a good time to think critically about all of the assumptions that we have put into, like, you know, how a church should spend their money. There's one thread in particular that the Apostle Paul brings up that as part of that I want to carry through. And that is this aspect of, like when the New Testament, when Paul talks about collecting money for, like, you know, for the church, what is he talking about? It's helpful to actually anchor on that, and then we can build out from there and clear out preconceptions that we may have on it. Because, you know, for example, I think that a lot of times when, people talk about, like, giving to their church, they might use language like, oh yeah, it's tithing. This is my tithe. And for those of you who aren't familiar, tithing just means tenth, right? It comes from a tradition established in the law, in the Torah, in the Old Covenant, where Jewish people would use a tenth of part of their finances to give to various causes within Israel. Even then, it's actually helpful to think about, like, in the Old Testament in particular, there were essentially three tithes. One tithe was to support the Levites. So they were the professional religious people whose job it was to take care of the temple complex. And they didn't have an inheritance, so they were being supported by the community collectively. There was a second tithe that was to support the religious festivals that they celebrated, like Passover, which is going on this week. And then there was a third one that was supposed to support local Levites and widows, orphans, strangers, and the poor in their midst. So there's even layers to that. It's not as straightforward as, like, they just, like, took 10% of their, like, gross profits of that year and just gave it to the, you know, like, the overall community. There are levels to how they spent that money. I think what often happens in our cases is we think, like, okay, they did that. That was the Old Testament. And now the collection that we do, that's the New Testament tithe. Like, that has replaced the tithe that the Jewish people did. And that doesn't seem to be how anybody in the New Testament thought about it when they were doing their collection. In fact, that idea is often, like, it's, you know, hints of a kind of anti-Semitic, like, replacement theology, like, oh, there was, you know, that was the tithe, now we do the collection. It has replaced that. Just like, it's like, there, we used to do circumcision, now we do baptism. We used to meet on the Sabbath, now we meet on Sunday, right? Like, as if none of those things are true. That kind of dichotomy that, like, oh, the church has done these things that have replaced things that Jewish people did, that's not true, right? The new Israel is Israel. They've been around the whole time, right? And the church was an outgrowth of that. So it's helpful to then, like, to think, okay, well, if it's not like when the church organized itself, they were like, all right, we're a church, synagogues do tithes, we got to do our own version of that. Then what were they doing when they were pooling their money together? there is a very specific way that the Apostle Paul brings it up in these closing chapters of Romans. And he brings it up here because he's actually, like, you know, in closing, when a man reflects on, like, everything he has shared, he's also thinking about when he would love to visit the church in Rome sometime in the future. He hasn't had a chance to yet, but he would like to. So here's what he says. But now, with no further place for me in these regions, like where he is, I desire, as I have for many years, to come to you when I go to Spain. For I do hope to see you on my journey and to be sent on by you once I have enjoyed your company for a little while. At present, however, I'm going to Jerusalem in a ministry to the saints. For Macedonia and Achaia were pleased to share their resources with the poor among the saints at Jerusalem. This, he is talking about the collection, like the one that we read about in other texts. So as background for, like, okay, like, what is he talking about here, where he's, like, specifically traveling to collect money for Jewish Christians who are apparently going to be in some state of chronic poverty. So we actually have this from other letters of Paul. So, like, in one of his earliest letters in Galatians, he actually retells the story of where the impetus for this collection came from, okay? So this is him describing, you know, like a time when all of the apostles got together and they kind of made a division of labor, that some of them were gonna stick around the greater Jerusalem area and they were gonna minister to Jewish people, and then some of them were gonna go, like they were gonna travel and they were gonna minister to the Gentile people, Paul being one of those people who was going to be preaching to the Gentiles. So here's what he says. And when James and Cephas and John, who were acknowledged pillars, recognized the grace that had been given to me, they gave to Barnabas and me the right hand of fellowship, agreeing that we should go to the Gentiles and they to the circumcised. They asked only one thing, that we remember the poor, which was actually what I was eager to do. So here we have Paul actually laying out that he is about to go on a journey with Barnabas and other colleagues to preach the gospel to Gentiles all throughout the Mediterranean area, but he has another goal along with it, like while he's preaching. He is going to collect money from these Gentile churches, many of whom don't know any of these Jerusalem Christians, and he's going to bring that money back to the Jerusalem Christians, who again look like they're going to be in some state of poverty and need. Okay, so then you can see this come up in other letters that he writes. So in 1 Corinthians, he says, now concerning the collection for the saints, you should follow the directions I gave to the other churches of Galatia. On the first day of every week, each of you is to put aside and save whatever extra you earn so that collections need not be taken when I come. And when I arrive, I will send any whom you approve with letters to take your gift to Jerusalem. So now you see some of those little details starting to take shape that we, like, take for granted today. Like, he's saying, like, hey, it seems like there's a regular pattern of y'all getting together on Sunday, and there's, like, a perhaps a regular pattern of y'all collecting money when you do. I would like you to do that regularly, save up, so that when I'm there, I or somebody you trust can take that money on en route to the saints in Jerusalem who need it. Okay, so this is actually like a core part of the whole reason that Paul does what we call his missionary journeys. So you may have seen, like, a map like this, like in the back of your Bible. What it does is it tries to, using the historical references that you can cross-reference with external resources, tries to piece together, like, what routes Paul took for each of his missionary journeys. He did multiple ones. The map, I think this can be complicated, but the basic idea or theme that you will see is each time it starts from the, like, Jerusalem area, and it'll go around, and then he'll come back, and then he'll do it again, variety of ways. There's lots of interpretation, like, that you have to make to come up with your own theory of, like, all the different missionary journeys, but the point is clear. When Paul travels to preach the gospel, he has a goal of collecting this money to take care of the Jewish Christians who need it in Jerusalem. He will go, it's like almost like he's obsessed with it. Like it's like kind of one of his primary goals in addition to preaching the gospel. So you see in 2 Corinthians, he'll even, these are the lengths that he'll go to raise funds for this ministry. He'll say, what he says to the church in Corinth, okay? He says, we want you to know, brothers and sisters, about the grace of God that has been granted to the churches of Macedonia, for during a severe ordeal of affliction, their abundant joy and their extreme poverty have overflowed in a wealth of generosity on their part. For as I can testify, they voluntarily gave according to their means and even beyond their means, begging us earnestly for the favor of partnering in this ministry to the saints, and not as we expected. So this, he's telling the church in Corinth, like, look at it, such a great job the church in Macedonia did. They're so kind and so loving. And then he'll go on, he says the quiet part out loud in terms of like motivation. He says, now as you excel in everything, in faith and speech and knowledge, in utmost eagerness and in our love for you, so we want you to excel also in this generous undertaking. I do not say this as a command, but I am, by mentioning the eagerness of others, testing the genuineness of your love. For you know the generous act of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich. This is like from the playbook, like Social Psychology 101, like how to motivate people to do stuff they may not otherwise want to do, right? This is, Christine is in like fundraising and philanthropy for nonprofits. This is like a staple move that you can do, like this like social comparison is what he's doing. That's how much it is important to him to make sure that these Christians in Jerusalem are taken care of. That is where this collection idea comes from, okay? And so then when you go back to the original text that we're talking about in Romans, where he mentions it, there's an interesting an appeal that he makes that I actually think is core to what the message of Romans is all about. So this is what he says. He talks about these other churches that these Gentiles who have given money, and they said they were pleased to do this. And indeed, they owe it to them, meaning they owe it to the Jewish Christians, the poor Jewish Christians. For if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be of service to them in material things. You know, there is this enormous challenge that maybe we would take for granted, that the Apostle Paul is traveling to all of these places, preaching the good news and telling a bunch of Gentile Christians that they need to give, to love Jesus is to give their money to poor Christians in Jerusalem who are part of an entirely different culture, who they have an antagonistic relationship with, who they have never met, for an impact that they may never see. And he is asking to do this, and he says, you owe it to them, because they gifted you with God, the story of God that has been working through Israel all along. I think that language, to say that, for Paul to say, like, you owe it to them, is profound, and it's language that I think that we should lean into more to explore as Christians in the 21st century. There's like some really good philosophical works that really bring these types of discussions to the front. So there's the philosopher T.M. Scanlon, who wrote What We Owe Each Other. That's like this exploration of contractualism or social contract theory, to like really think through like why do we, in our attempts to do good, how much of it is motivated out of like what we owe to each other to do it. If that book sounds familiar to you, it's because it actually played a critical role in The Good Place. Like, it was actually the backbone philosophical text of that entire show, and I really appreciated that aspect of it. In a lot of ways, I think to use that language, like we do good to each other because we owe it to each other, is, I think, in a lot of ways, like, out of step with how like our very Western individualistic culture operates. And in fact, often we talk about like, you know, we hype each other up by saying like, you don't owe anybody anything, right? Like when you're thinking about like hard things that you have to do for the sake of other people. And even often like the ways that we talk about God's grace has been very much influenced by that very Western individualistic perspective. It is to say, like, for example, God's grace to you means that you don't owe God anything. You don't have to do anything in response. In fact, to do anything in response is a works righteousness, and works are like a filthy rag. The really what to accept God's grace means to accept it as it is, and you don't have to do anything about it. There are many scholars over the centuries who have critiqued that as not only would they argue that it's not biblical, it's not the way biblical writers would have talked about it, but that is a very like Western individualistic way of thinking about it, where you don't think about what people owe each other collectively. In the last few years, there's been a lot of great scholarship that has like attacked this very presumption about like what does God's grace mean, and when God graces us with gifts and salvation, does God expect anything in return for gifting us those blessings? And you know, I would argue the answer is yes. And that's different, I think, from like the way that a lot of us talk about it in our culture. I think this also shows up even outside of like just the way we think about you know, like God's grace or anything like that, where I think a lot of in the beautiful world these days, where more people are aware than ever about the factors that influence their mental health, there is like there is an undercurrent in like, especially like in America, in Western spaces, of talking about self-care as prioritizing yourself above others. So I asked ChatGPT to tell me what are some common slogans about self-care that influencers or people talk about in general on the internet. So here are the top 10 that it gave me. And again, I think like all of these you may agree with to like a varying degrees. I think there's sometimes a different spirit behind some of these. It's actually worth a discussion alone that you could have like with your friends or your small groups or wherever, where you can go through those and be like, how much do you agree or disagree with any of them? What are the assumptions that go into some of them? But like these are ones that I've heard people say both privately to me, publicly in other forums, like to say my well-being is my priority. I honor my needs first. I give from my overflow, not from my reserves. Setting boundaries is an act of self-love. I release guilt for prioritizing my own needs. Okay, so there's several. These are, again, they're very interesting. And I know that much of them come from what I would say is a good place of trying to help people who are deteriorating on the inside because of how much they are trying to help other people, okay? I get that, and I affirm that. I think that's absolutely something that we should, we should embrace. The challenge is, though, often the thesis that you're given to be like, I know that for so long you've sacrificed yourself for other people to the extent that it's like killing you inside, but you know what? You don't owe them anything. You come first. I would argue that thesis is not the best or the most biblical response to that type of attitude. And again, there are many therapists or folk therapists or influencers online who will pass that off as like, social scientific wisdom. Again, like I therapists can range in the presuppositions that they bring to the table. And one of the ones that at least in American therapy that's very common is to embrace these assumptions of, the most important way to understand yourself is an individual within society with autonomy and freedom, that you decide what is best for you, and other people come second to that. That is often like a framework that many people are coming from when they offer advice. And that comes from a place of, I would argue, even a flaw in how we do social science and like the underlying psychological theories that go into therapy. So I am a social scientist, so I'm offering an in-house criticism of my world. There's a common phrase that we use where we say social science is weird. Weird is an acronym that describes the ways in which much of our knowledge about social science and how people's minds work is systematically biased by the people who do that research and the participants upon which they do that research. So it goes, you know, the systematic biases that have been identified is social science, that as we know it, is very Western. It is insights from the educated, from the industrialized, rich, and they come from rich and democratic countries. So these are like, you know, the insights that come out of like, hey, this is what will work best for your mental health. This is how you can persuade people to do what you need them to do. This is how you can like perform 10% better at work. They often come from this type of perspective where it is prioritizing you as an individual above everything else. To which I would say, how would social science and therapy and our interpretations of God's grace and how we think about benevolence be different if instead we challenged those kinds of perspectives and thought more from a collectivist perspective about like what do we owe each other just by the nature of all of us being humans together? There's a thread within the early church that I think uses, that really leans into this like owing language that I think is like, it's good to dwell on for us today. So this is from the Didache, which was a text like very early in church history. So it's like likely around like the first century. Some early New Testament canon lists included the Didache in the Bible, like in their like canonical New Testament. And so there are lines in texts like these that say, share everything with your brother. Do not say it is private property. If you share what is everlasting, you should be that much more willing to share things which do not last. The next century, you have writers like Irenaeus saying, instead of the tithes which the law commanded, the Lord said to divide everything we have with the poor. And he said to love not only our neighbors, but also our enemies, and to be givers and sharers not only with the good, but also to be liberal givers toward those who take away our possessions. And a couple centuries after that, you have Basil of Caesarea saying, the bread in your cupboard belongs to the hungry man. The coat hanging in your closet belongs to the man who needs it. The shoes rotting in your closet belong to the man who has no shoes. The money which you put into the bank belongs to the poor. Now you can be thinking like, wait a second, I live in a capitalist world. That stuff makes me nervous. And I understand. I'm not saying we got to translate that philosophy into some kind of like how we want to structure markets in the 21st century. That's not the point. The point is they are coming from a premise of there is just by the nature of a poor person existing in your world, they are owed certain things from you. And for all of them, it's because all of it belongs to God, and everyone involved in these systems belong to God. That's where it's coming from. So you have somebody like Ambrose of Milan saying, you are not making a gift of your possession to the poor person. You are handing over to him what is his. That is an undercurrent to what Paul is saying to these Jewish and Gentile Christians all along in this letter. Yes, you owe it to them. You may hate them. They don't practice loving Jesus the way that you do, but you owe it to them to respect them and honor them and give from what you have to them. All right, that was money. Second one, let's talk about meat, okay? It's another thread that occurs in Romans. So this starts where Paul will bring it up in this discussion where he says, welcome those who are weak in faith, but not for the purpose of quarreling over opinions. Some believe in eating anything, while the weak eat only vegetables. Those who eat must not despise those who abstain, and those who abstain must not pass judgment on those who eat, for God has welcomed them. Now, you read this and you're like, there's a lot of terms here that I think mean something different than what it looks like on the surface. Because you see the phrase, the weak eat only vegetables. And you're like, what? Is that Paul or is that what my fitness influencer said on Instagram, right? So let's actually talk through in context what Paul is talking about here. When in this specific argument that Paul makes, he Sorry, by the way, I've distracted myself with this. You're welcome for not using a joke about Jesus's abs on the previous slide. I could have done that. Think about the enormous self-restraint that it took for me not to do that. But all right, so here, when the Apostle Paul talks about strong and weak, what he means is someone who is strong in conviction. So you have, like, in this community, you have people, you have Jewish Christians who have historically eaten kosher. And you have Gentile Christians who never have. And there's this profound question that is at the heart of many of the issues in this community, which asks, like, how much do Gentile Christians need to be Jewish in order to belong to God's family, which, has been Jewish all along up until now, right? Which is a very good question for this community to grapple with, right? And it looks like there were a variety of conclusions that people drew. Some people concluded that, right, now in the New Covenant era, you know, Gentiles can eat all kinds of meat. They don't need to eat kosher to be in God's family, right? And then you have some Gentiles who would be like, and you, Jewish Christians, you don't need to eat kosher either. It's all done. Like, you know, that's like, it's over. So there's, like, you know, good room for discussion and debate about this. What Paul would say here rhetorically, he's saying the person with strong conviction is the one who knows that it's okay either way, whether you choose not to eat meat. And by that, like, so, you know, Jewish people in these communities, they ate kosher. But if you're out and about, like, you know, in a typical pagan restaurant, and there are no kosher meat options available, effectively that would mean they ate vegetarian. So that's what it means to say that they eat only vegetables. So the person with strong conviction is, Paul would say, someone like him who knows that it's all good either way. But you could have somebody with a weak conviction. He would say, somebody who does not feel comfortable eating meat, eating non-kosher meat, even if they know that, or, you know, even if, like, other people in the community have taught them that it's okay. And I know, this debate may seem, like, weird or quaint to you, but think about it for them in terms of, like, core cultural identity. It is, like, who they are, and it is these two communities saying, like, your way of expressing who you are and your faith in God is not valid anymore. Right? So that's where this is coming from. We all have our kinds of fault lines like that today, where we would say, like, you know, if you are going to be a Christian, you need to do and believe X, Y, and Z. And if you don't, I struggle to welcome you. That applies. That is what this discussion is about. And here, even then, Paul says, like, look, you may think it's all good, but if you're with somebody who is, or, like, questions what you're doing together, you owe it to them to change your behavior, to be sensitive to their conscience. That's what he is saying. So he'll, a few verses later, he'll say, for we do not live to ourselves and we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord. And if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. And then he says, let us therefore no longer pass judgment on one another, but resolve instead never to put a stumbling block or hindrance in the way of a brother or sister. If your brother or sister is distressed by what you eat, you are no longer walking in love. Do not let what you eat cause the ruin of one for whom Christ died. So again, for you, it's not like eating kosher meat or not. But some of you who maybe came from restrictive religious backgrounds maybe used to think, like, drinking was wrong. And then maybe you went through a phase where it became fine for you, and you didn't like all those stuffy people in your church community who were like, oh, that's wrong. I'm not comfortable doing that. And you became that guy in, being like, come on, don't you just want a little sip, right? Like, this is what Paul is saying here is, don't be that person, right? It is that, like, in other parts of Romans, he says, look, the kingdom of God is not about eating and drinking. In other words, these are not the kind of things that you do to destroy other people. The decisions that you make, what you consume, who you hang out with, what you do, they do to some extent, like it matters how the people in your community perceive those actions. And again, I know that many of you have come from communities where for a long time, that's how they weaponized compliance, right? They would be like, look, you can't go to that party because of the appearance of evil, right? That's like a common phrase that many of us have like religious background in, right? And so everything was like, yeah, you could do that, but appearance of evil, don't do it. And now you are free. You're like, I'm no longer gonna worry about that anymore. And that's fine, but don't do it because you're like, I'm a do me, right? That is not the right attitude. That is a very Western and individualistic attitude to have. Because I would argue, no, you still owe all of those people who you no longer agree with because you're freed in Christ. You have a strong conscience, right? You still owe all of those people that have a weak conscience to you. You owe them your behavior, right? And we've got to figure out healthy ways to do it together where you're not deteriorating on the inside, but at the same time, you can't be destroying them either. This is how the Apostle Paul wraps it up, again, using this ought language, right? He says, we who are strong ought to put up with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves. Each of us must please our neighbor for the good purpose of building up the neighbor. For Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the insults of those who insulted you have fallen on me. And then he summarizes this whole thing, which I would argue is the thesis of the letter to the Romans. Welcome one another, therefore, just as Christ welcomed you. All right. Our last thread will bring it home. This is the mentions. So what I mean by this is all of the people that the Apostle Paul calls out in the closing chapter in the letter to the Romans. So this is an example of like, you think that he's wrapping it up. It's like when, we were just talking about this with Bob and Shelley the other day, like when kids are asking, when are we gonna leave for the party? And the adults are like walking to the door and then they talk for another 30 minutes about all kinds of things and people. And then you realize like, we're not actually close to like getting out the door. This is that kind of thing where this is wrapping it up. But then Paul is like, all right, by the way, I'm sending you Phoebe. Say hi to her, treat her well. Also say hi to this person and that person, Say hello, you know, like he goes on. So this is actually like this stretch of text, right? In Romans 16, where Paul says, these are all greetings, okay? He mentions several people. And yet, like, I think for many years, I, as an interpreter and many interpreters, kind of just like overlook this list to be like, great, these are all people that Paul knew or like wanted to meet someday. But I have come to learn since then that there, the people that he is mentioning and the people that he is praising in this text are very much in line with the spirit of what we have been talking about all along in this letter. Here too, in his closing thoughts. These are all the people that he names, okay? So these are the individuals that he's talking about. This is them. One of the many things that scholars have done over the years is identify these people's backgrounds by their names and like other signals from historical context and other letters that we have on them. So once you can deconstruct it that way, you will see that the Apostle Paul has built a team of followers of Jesus who would make like a 21st century big tech DEI and, you know, diversity inclusion team jealous with like the range of social strata we have here. So these are people that are, from context clues, we can identify as Jewish. The other people are Gentile. So this is a community that he is calling out. People who live together and do community together, being both Jewish and Gentile. Also from context clues, we can infer that some of these people were slaves and others were free. And then we can infer, too, that these were women and the others were men. And again, you may take all of these things for granted, but can you imagine an outsider in the first century looking at this kind of list being like, what kind of organization is this that have these kinds of people that not only know each other, but owe each other things? Like, that is profound in what the Apostle Paul is highlighting here. There are a few women in particular that I think are worth calling out. So Tryphena and Tryphosa, he lists as co-workers in the Lord. That is a phrase that he uses in other letters to describe preachers like himself. So there you go. You know, question about like, can women preach or not? They literally can't. Paul literally named ones that could. Phoebe, he literally calls in this text a deacon of the church in Cenchrea. And he even says, he describes her as a benefactor. So she has some kind of like power and influence, and has helped Paul in his own ministry. And then there's Phoebe, there's Junia, who he mentions as well. As he says, greet Andronicus and Junia, who are noteworthy apostles. It is especially interesting for Junia because an apostle, in the ranking of the early church would outrank all of these people that we mentioned. To be an apostle was had carried a lot of responsibility and weight with it. It's probably not surprising to you to learn that among the people who would say women shouldn't have leadership positions, that woman's name listed in Romans 16 has caused a great deal of consternation. In fact, they have made, for the last several centuries, there was an interpretive move to literally just say, oh yeah, that name is actually Junius, a man. That's literally what is done, because it is easier to believe that that is the appropriate way to name that person than to believe that a powerful woman could have held authority in the early church. I think it's hilarious too that for those critics, this is the only kind of transgenderism they accept. It's a powerful woman in leadership, make her a man. That's the kind that they will take. There is there's a great book that kind of summarizes this perspective that I have taken to heart very well, as it is shown in the naming of one of our daughters. The first J in JJ is Junia, and it's because of how much my deep appreciation of what Paul is doing in this text. And so scholars have really showed this history of this weird history of how churches for various times and various stretches have tried to downplay the significance of Junia in that case. So those are these threads, right? They are all, at the end of it, really about welcoming one another just as God welcomed each of us. And my point in all of this is actually not to position Paul and the early church as if they were 21st century feminist, anti-racist, anti-classist, DEI heroes. The early church was never some utopia that we have since lost and that we now need to restore. That's not the point that I've been trying to make. The point is not look at how great they were. Look at how forward-thinking they were. It's look at how great God was and how forward-thinking God was, even when they weren't. That is really what's coming through in this letter. Neither Paul nor his readers were perfect. But when we go through a text like Romans and really dwell on verse after verse after verse, what we are saying is that even if the interpreters and the readers weren't perfect, the mind, the ultimate mind behind the text is perfect. And it is that mind that energizes us to be more loving every single day, so that, as the Apostle Paul says, where sin abounds, grace abounds even more. That is the direction that this letter is pushing us. There is a beautiful quote that I came across recently that summarizes that. It's from a 20th century German Catholic priest that captures this very idea, where there is no love without sin, for love is measured in what we forgive. Now, some of you, I don't know, do you know who Kurt Wagner is? That's Nightcrawler from the X-Men 97 cartoon. This actually showed up in an episode just 2 weeks ago. Y'all are sleeping on the Nightcrawler's theology in X-Men. He almost made Wolverine become a Christian. Think about that. Think about how serious his level of theology is. Was this a very silly, odd way to end our entire series on Romans? Yes. But was it the right way? Also, yes. I stand by that. This is where we're at, okay? All right. Thank you all so much for going with us on this journey. We're now transitioning to our time together, where we practice communion, where we really show with the way we live our lives that we are one with each other. We belong to each other. And we use that with the tradition that was handed down to us over the centuries. For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, "Take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.